of his concerned-looking nurse. Dercius crossed back to him. "Would I let you down?" he chuckled. He pulled a signet ring off his left little finger and hugged Ibram to his side. "Know what this is? A ring! Smart boy! But it's more." Dercius carefully turned the milled edge of the ring setting, and it popped open. A thin, truncated beam of laser light stabbed out. "Do you know what this is?" Ibram shook his head. "It's a key. Officers like me need a way to open certain secret dispatches, secret orders. You know what they are?"
"My father told me. There are different codes. It's called security clearance."
Dercius and the others laughed at the precocity of the little boy. But there was a false note in it.
"You're right. Codes like Panther, Aesculus, Cryptox, or the old color code levels, Cyan, Scarlet.
It goes up, Magenta, Obsidian, and Vermilion," Dercius said, taking the ring off.
"Generals like me are given these signet rings to open and decode them."
"Does my father have one, Uncle?"
A pause.
"Of course."
"Is my father coming home? Is he with you?"
"Listen to me, Ibram. There's..."
Ibram took the ring and studied it.
"Can I really have this, Uncle Dercius? Is it for me?"
Ibram looked up suddenly from the ring in his hands and found that everyone was staring at him intently.
"I didn't steal it,"
he announced.
"Of course you can have it. It's yours," Dercius said, hunkering down by his side, looking as if he was preoccupied by something. "Listen, Ibram, there's something I have to tell you about your father."
Part 5. The Empyrean. 1. Gaunt had been talking to Ferrid. They had sat by a fuel-drum fire in the splintered shadows of a residence in the demilitarized zone of Passion 960's largest city. Ferrid was disguised as a farm boss in the thick, red wool robes common to many on Passion, and he was talking obliquely about spy work, just the sort of half-complete, enticing remarks he liked to tease his commissar friend with. An unlikely pair, the commissar and the imperial spy, one tall, lean and blonde, the other compact and dark. Thrown together by the circumstances of combat, they were bonded and loyal, despite the differences of their backgrounds and duties. Ferrid's intelligence unit, working the city farms of Passion in deep cover, had revealed the foul chaos cult and the heretic navy officers in their thrall. A disastrous fleet action, brought in too hastily in response to Ferrid's discovery, had led to open war on the planet itself and the deployment of the Guard. Chance had led Gaunt's Hyrkins to the raid which had rescued Ferrid from the hands of the Passion traitors. Together, Gaunt and Ferrid had unveiled and executed the traitor Baron Sylag. They were talking about loyalty and treachery, and Ferrid was saying how the vigilance of the Emperor's spy networks was the only thing that kept the private ambitions of various senior officers in check. But it was difficult for Gaunt to follow Ferrid's words because his face kept changing. Sometimes he was Oktar, and then, in the flame light, his face would become that of Dercius or Gaunt's father. With a grunt, Gaunt realized he was dreaming, bade his friend goodbye, and, dissatisfied, he awoke. The air was unpleasantly stuffy and stale. His room was small, with a low, curved ceiling and inset lighting plates that he had turned down to their lowest setting before retiring. He got up and pulled on his clothes, scattered where he had left them. Breeches, dress shirt, boots, a short leather field jacket with a high collar embossed with interlocked imperial eagles. Firearm screening fields meant there was no bolt pistol in his holster on the door hook, but he took his Tanith knife. He opened the door hatch and stepped out into the long, dark space of the companionway. The air here was hot and stifling too, but it moved, wafted by the circulation systems under the black metal grille of the floor. A walk would do him good. It was night cycle, and the deck lamps were low. There was the ever-present murmur of the vast power plants and the resulting micro-vibration in every metal surface, even the air itself. Gaunt walked for 15 minutes or more in the silent passageways of the great structure, meeting no one. At a confluence of passageways, he entered the main spinal lift and keyed his passcode into the rune pad on the wall. There was an electronic moan as cycles set, and a 3-second chant sung by non-human throats to signal the start of the lift. The indicator light flicked slowly up 20 bas-relief glass runes on the polished brass board. Another burst of that soft, artificial choir. The doors opened. Gaunt stepped out into the glass bay, a dome of transparent, hyper-dense silica 100 meters in radius. It was the most serene place the structure offered. Beyond the glass, a magnificent, troubling vista swirled, filtered by special dampening fields. Darkness, striated light, blistering strands and filaments of colors he wasn't sure he could put a name to. Bands of light and dark shifting past at an inhuman rate. The Imperium. Warp space. The dimension beyond reality through which this structure, the mass cargo conveyance Absalom, now moved. He had first seen the Absalom through the thick, tinted ports of the shuttle that had brought him up to meet it in orbit. He was in awe of it. One of the ancient transport ships of the Adeptus Mechanicus, a veteran vessel. The tech lords of Mars had sent a massive retinue to aid the disaster at Fortis, and now, in gratitude for the liberation, they subordinated their vessels to the Imperial Guard. It was an honor to travel on the Absalom, Gaunt well knew, to be conveyed by the mysterious secret carriers of the God-Machine cult. From the shuttle, he'd seen 16 solid kilometers of gray architecture, like a raked, streamlined cathedral, with the tiny lights of the troop transports flickering in and out of its open belly mouth. The crenellated surfaces and towers of the mighty Mechanicus ship were rich with bas-relief gargoyles, out of whose wide fanged mouths the turrets of the sentry guns traversed and swung. Green interior light shone from thousands of slit windows. The pilot tug, obese and blackened with the scorch marks of its multiple attitude thrusters, bellied in the slow solar tides ahead of the transport vessel. Gaunt's flagship, the great frigate Navarre, had been seconded for picket duties to the Nubular Reach, so Gaunt had chosen to travel with his men on the Absalom. He missed the long, sleek, waspish lines of the Navarre, and he missed the crew, especially Executive Officer Kreff, who had tried so hard to accommodate the Commissar and his unruly men. The Absalom was a different breed of beast, a behemoth. Its echoing bulk capacity allowed it to carry 9 full regiments, including the Tanith, 4 divisions of the Janteen Patricians, and at least 3 mechanized battalions, including their many tanks and armored transport vehicles. Fat lift ships had hefted the numerous war machines up into the hold from the depots on Pyrites. Now they were en route, a 6-day jump to a cluster of war worlds called the Menozoid Clasp, the next defined line of battle in the Sabbat Worlds campaign. Gaunt hoped for deployment with the Ghosts into the main assault on Menozoid Sigma, the capital planet, where a large force of chaos was holding the line against a heavy Imperial advance. But there was also Menozoid Epsilon, the remote dark death world at the edge of the clasp. Gaunt knew that Warmaster Makaroth's planning staff were assessing the impact of that world. He knew some regimental units would be deployed to take it. No one wanted Epsilon. No one wanted to die. He looked up into the festering, fluctuating light of the Imperium beyond the glass and uttered a silent prayer to the Most Blessed Emperor. Spare us from Epsilon. Other, even gloomier thoughts clouded his mind. Like the infernal, invaluable crystal that had come into his hands on Pyrites. Its very presence, its unlockable secret, burned in the back of his mind like a melter gun wound. No further word had come from Ferid. No signal, not even a hint of what was expected of him. Was he to be a courier? If so, for how long? How would he know who to trust the precious jewel to when the time came? Was something else wanted from him? Had some further vital instruction failed to reach him? Their long friendship aside, Gaunt cursed the memory of Ferid. This kind of complication was unwelcome on top of the demands of his commissarial duties. He resolved to guard the crystal, carry it until Ferid told him otherwise. But still, he fretted that the matter was of the highest importance, and time was somehow slipping away. He crossed the knurled rail at the edge of the bay and leaned heavily on it. The enormity of the warp shuffled and spasmed in front of him, milky tendrils of proto-matter licking like ribbons of fluid mist against the outside of the glass. The glass bay was one of three Immaterium observatories on the Absalom, allowing the navigators and the clerics of the Astrographicus division visual access to the void. In the center of the bay's deck, on a vast platform mechanism of oiled cogs and toothed gears, giant sensorium scopes, aura imagifiers, and luminosity evaluators cycled and turned, regarding the maelstrom, charting, cogitating, assessing and transmitting the assembled data via chattering relays and humming crystal stacks to the main bridge 8 kilometers away, at the top of the Absalom's tallest command spire. The observatories were not forbidden areas, but their spaces were not recommended for those new to space crossings. It was said that if the glass wasn't shielded, the view could derange and twist the minds of even hardened astrographers. The elevator's choral chime had been intended to warn Gaunt of this. But he had seen the Imperium before, countless times on his voyages. It no longer scared him. Filtered in this way, he found the fluctuations of the warp somehow easeful, as if its cataclysmic turmoil allowed his own mind to rest. He could think here. Around the edge of the dome, the names of militant commanders, lord generals and master admirals were etched into the polished ironwork of the sill in a roll of honour. Under each name was a short legend indicating the theatres of their victories. Some names he knew, from the history texts and the required reading at the Schola back on Ignatius. Some, their inscriptions old and faded, were unknown, 10 centuries dead. He worked his way around the edge of the dome, reading the plaques. It took him almost half a circuit before he found the name of the one he had actually known personally. Warmaster Slado, Makaroth's predecessor, dead at the infamous triumph of Balhaut in the 10th year of this crusade through the Sabbat worlds. Gaunt glanced around from his study. The elevator doors at the top of the transit shaft hissed open, and he caught once more a snatch of the chanted warning chime. A figure stepped out onto the deck, a navy rating, carrying a small instrument kit. The rating looked across at the lone figure by the rail for a moment, and then turned away and disappeared from view behind the lift assembly. An inspection patrol, Gaunt decided absently. He turned back to the inscriptions and read Slado's plaque again. He remembered Balhaut, the firestorms that swept the night away and took the forces of chaos with it. He and his beloved Hyrkans had been at the center of it, in the mud lakes, struggling through the brimstone atmosphere under the weight of their heavy rebreathers. Slado had taken credit for that famous win, rightly enough as Warmaster, but in sweat and blood it had been Gaunt's. His finest hour, and he had Slado's deathbed decoration to prove it. He could hear the grind of the enemy assault carriers even now, striding on their long hydraulic legs through the mud, peppering the air with sharp needle blasts of blood-red light, washing death and fire towards his men. A physical memory of the tension and fatigue ran down his spine. The superhuman effort with which he and his best fire teams had stormed the oligarchy gate ahead of even the glorious forces of the Adeptus Astartes, driving a wedge of lasfire and grenade bursts through the overlapping plates of the enemy's buttress screens. He saw Tannhaus making his lucky shot, still talked about in the barracks of the Hyrkan, a single lasbolt that penetrated a foul, demented Chaos dreadnought through the visor slit, detonating the power systems within. He saw Veach taking 6 of the foe with his bayonet when his last power cell ran dry. He saw the tower of the plutocrat combust and fall under the sustained Hyrkan fire. He saw the faces of the unnumbered dead rising from the mud, from the flames. He opened his eyes, and the visions fled. The Empyrean lashed and blossomed in front of him, unknowable. He was about to turn and return to his quarters, but there was a blade at his throat. 2. There was no sense of anyone behind him, no shadow, no heat, no sound or smell of breath. It was as if the cold sharpness under his chin had arrived there unaccompanied. He knew at once he was at the mercy of a formidable opponent. But that alone gave him a flicker of confidence. If the blade's owner had simply wanted him dead, then he would already be dead, and none the wiser. There was something that made him more useful alive. He was fairly certain what that was. "What do you want?" he asked calmly.
"No games,"
a voice said from behind him. The tone was low and even, not a whisper, but of a level that was somehow softer and lower still. The pressure of the cold blade increased against the skin of his neck, fractionally.
You are reckoned to be an intelligent man. Dispense with the delaying tactics.
Gaunt nodded carefully. If he was going to live even a minute more, he had to play this precisely right.
This isn't the way to solve this, Brockus, he said carefully.
There was a pause.
What?
Now who's playing games? I know what this is about. I'm sorry you and your patrician comrades lost face on Pyrites. Lost a few teeth, too, I'll bet. But this won't help.
Don't be a fool. You've got this wrong. This isn't about some stupid regimental rivalry.
It isn't.
Think hard, fool. Think why this might really be happening. I want you to understand why you are about to die.
The weight of the blade against his throat shifted slightly. It didn't lessen its pressure, but there was a momentary alteration in the angle. Gaunt knew his comments had misdirected his adversary for a heartbeat. His only chance. He struck backwards hard with his right elbow, simultaneously pulling back from the blade and raising his left hand to fend it off. The knife cut through his cuff, but he pulled clear as his assailant reeled from the elbow jab. Gaunt had barely turned when the other countered, striking high. They fell together, limbs twisting to gain a positive hold. The wayward blade ripped Gaunt's jacket open down the seam of the left sleeve. Gaunt forced the center of balance over and threw a sideways punch with his right fist that knocked his assailant off him. A moment later, the commissar was on his feet, drawing the silver Tanith blade from his belt. He saw his opponent for the first time. The Navy rating, a short, lean man of indeterminate age. There was something strange about him. The way his mouth was set in a determined grimace, while his wide eyes seemed to be pleading? The rating flipped up onto his feet with a scissor of his back and legs, and coiled around in a hunched, offensive posture, the knife held blade uppermost in his right hand. How could a deck rating know moves like that? Gaunt worried. The practice movements, the perfect balance, the silent resolve, all betrayed a specialist killer, an adept in the arts of stealth and assassination. But close up, Gaunt saw the man was just an engineer, his naval uniform a little tight around a belly going to fat. Was it just a disguise? The rank pins, insignia, and the coded identity seal mandatory for all crew personnel all seemed real. The blade was short and leaf-shaped, shorter than the rubberized grip it protruded from. There was a series of geometric holes in the body of the blade itself, reducing the overall weight whilst retaining the structural strength. It plainly wasn't metal. It was matte blue, ceramic, invisible to the ship's weapon scan fields. Gaunt stared into the other's unblinking eyes, searching for recognition or contact. The gaze which met him was a desperate, piteous look, as if from something trapped inside the menacing body. They circled, slowly. Gaunt kept his body angled and low, as he had learned in bayonet drill with the Hyakans. But he held the Tanith blade loosely in his right hand, with the blade descending from the fist and tilted in towards his body. He'd watched the odd style the ghosts had used in knife drill with interest. One long week in transit aboard the Navarre, he had got Corbeck to train him in the nuances. The method made good use of the weight and length of the Tanith war knife. He kept his left hand up to block, not with a warding open palm as the Hyakans had practiced, and as his opponent now adopted, but in a fist, knuckles outward.
Better to stop a blade with your hand than your throat,
Tannhaus had told him years before. Better the blade cracks off your knuckles than opens a smile in your palm, Corbeck had finessed more recently.
You want me dead? Gaunt hissed.
That was not my primary objective. Where is the crystal?
Gaunt started as the man replied. Though the mouth moved, the voice was not coming from it. The lip movements barely synced with the words. He'd seen that before somewhere, years ago. It looked like possession. Gaunt bristled as fear ran down his back. More than the fear of mortal combat, the fear of witchcraft,
of psychers.
A commissar colonel won't be easily missed, Gaunt managed. The rating shrugged stiffly, as if to indicate the infinite raging vastness beyond the glass dome.
No one is so important he won't be missed out here. Not even the War Master himself.
They had circled three times now.
Where is the crystal?
The rating asked again.
What crystal?
The one you acquired in Crecia City,
returned the killer in that floating, unmatched voice.
Give it up now, and we can forget this meeting ever took place.
Who sent you?
Nothing in the known systems would make me answer that question.
I have no crystal. I don't know what you're talking about.
A lie.
Even if it was, would I be so foolish to carry anything with me?
I've searched your quarters twice. It's not there. You must have it. Did you swallow it? Dissection is not beyond me.
Gaunt was about to reply when the rating suddenly stamped forward, circling his blade in a sweep that missed the commissar's shoulder by a hair's breadth. Gaunt was about to feint and counter when the blade swept back in a reverse of the slice. The touch of a stud on the grip had caused the ceramic blade to retract with a pneumatic hiss and re-extend through the flat pommel of the grip, reversing the angle. The tip sheared through his blocking left forearm and sprayed blood across the deck. Gaunt leapt backwards with an angry curse, but the rating followed through relentlessly, reversing his blade again so it poked up forward of his punching fist. Gaunt blocked it with an improvised turn of his knife and kicked out at the attacker, catching his left knee with his boot tip. The man backed off, but the circling did not recommence. This was unlike the sparring in bayonet training, the endless measuring and dancing, the occasional clash and jab. The man rallied immediately after each feint, each deflection, and struck in once more, clicking his blade up and down out of the grip to wrong foot Gaunt, sometimes striking with an upwards blow on the first stroke and thumbing the blade downwards to rake on the return. Gaunt survived 8, 9, 10 potentially lethal passes, thanks only to his speed and the attacker's unfamiliarity with the curious Tanith blade technique. They clashed again, and this time Gaunt jabbed not with his knife but with his warding left hand, directly at the man's weapon. The blade cut a stinging gash in his knuckles, but he slipped in under the knife and grabbed the man by the right wrist. They clenched, Gaunt driving forwards with his superior size and height. The man's left hand found his throat and clamped it in an iron grip. Gaunt gagged, choking, his vision swimming as his neck muscles fought against the tightening grip. Desperately, he slammed the man backwards into the guardrail. The rating thumbed his blade catch again, and the reversing tongue of ceramic stabbed down into Gaunt's wrist. In return, he plunged his own knife hard through the tricep of the arm holding his throat. They broke, reeling away from each other, blood spurting from the stab wounds in their arms and hands. Gaunt was panting and short of breath from the pain, but the man made no sound, as if he felt no pain, or as if pain was no hindrance to him. The rating came at him again, and Gaunt swung low to block, but at the last moment the man tossed the ceramic blade from his right hand to his left, the blade reversing itself through the grip in mid-air so that what had started as an upward strike from the right turned into a downward stab from the left. The blade dug into the meat of Gaunt's right shoulder, deadened only by the padding and leather of his jacket. White-hot pain lanced down his right side, crushing his ribs and the breath inside them. The blade slid free cleanly, and blood drizzled after it. The hot warmth was coursing down the inside of his sleeve and slickening his grip on the knife handle. It dripped off his knuckles and the silver blade. If he kept bleeding at that rate, even if he could hold off his assailant, he knew he would not survive much longer. The rating crossed his guard again, switching hands like a juggler, to the right and then back to the left, reversing the blade direction with each return. He feinted, sliced in low at Gaunt's belly with a left-hand pass, and then pushed himself at the commissar. Gaunt stabbed in to meet the low cut and caught the point of his silver blade through one of the perforations in the ceramic blade. Instinctively, he wrenched his blade back and levered at the point of contact. A second later, the ceramic tech knife whirled away across the glass bay and skittered out of sight over the cold floor. Suddenly disarmed, the rating hesitated for a heartbeat, and Gaunt rammed his Tanith knife up and in, puncturing the man's torso and cracking his sternum. The rating reeled away sharply, sucking for air as his lungs failed. The silver knife was stuck fast in his chest. Thin blood jetted from the wound and gurgled from his slack mouth. He hit the deck, knees first, then fell flat on his face, his torso propped up like a tent on the hard metal prong of the knife. Gaunt stumbled back against the rail, gasping hoarsely, his body shaking and burning pain jeering at him. He wiped a bloody hand across his clammy, ashen face and gazed down at the rating's body as it lay on the floor in a pool of scarlet fluid. He sank to the deck, trembling and weak. A laugh, half chuckle, half sob, broke from him. When next he saw Colm Corbeck, he would buy him the biggest. The rating got up again. The man wriggled back on his knees, rippling the pool of blood around him, and then swung his body up straight, arms swaying limp at his sides. Kneeling, he slowly turned his head to face the prone, dismayed Gaunt. His face was blank, and his eyes were no longer pleading and trapped. They were gone, in fact. A fierce green light raged inside his skull, making his eyes pupilless slits of lime fire. His mouth lolled open, and a similar glow shone out, backlighting his teeth. With one simple direct motion, he pulled the Tanith knife out of his chest. There was no more blood, just a shaft of bright green light poking from the wound. With a sigh of finality, Gaunt knew that the psychic puppetry was continuing. The man, who had been a helpless thrall of the psycho magic when he first attacked, was now reanimated by abominable sorcery. It would function long enough to win the fight. It would kill him. Gaunt battled with his senses to keep awake, to get up, to run. He was blacking out. The rating swayed towards him, like a zumbe from the old myths of the non-dead, eyes shining, expression blank, the Tanith blade that had killed him clutched in the claw of a hand. The dead thing raised the knife to strike. 3. Two las shots slammed it sideways. Another tight pair broke it open along the ribcage, venting an incandescent halo of bright psychic energy. A fifth shot to the head dropped the thing like it had been struck in the ear with a sledgehammer. Colm Corbeck, the las pistol in his hand, stalked across the deck of the glass bay and stood looking down at the charred and smouldering shape on the floor, a shape that had self-ignited and was spilling vaporous green energies as it ate itself up. Somewhere, the weapon's interdiction alarm started wailing. Using the rail for support, Gaunt was almost on his feet again by the time Corbeck reached him. "Easy there, Commissar." Gaunt waved him off, aware of the way his blood was still feebly dribbling onto the deck.
"Your timing," he grunted, "is perfect, Colonel."
Corbeck grimly gestured over his shoulder. Gaunt turned to look where he pointed. Bryn Milo stood by the elevator assembly, looking flushed and fierce. "The lad had a dream," Corbeck said, refusing to be ignored and looping his arm under his commander's shoulder. "Came to me at once when he couldn't find you in your quarters." Milo crossed to them.
"The wounds need attention," he said.
"We'll get him to the apothecarian," Corbeck began.
"No,"
Milo said firmly, and, despite the pain, Gaunt almost laughed at the sudden authority his junior aide directed at the shaggy brute who was the company commander.
"Back to our barrack decks. Use our own medics. I don't think the Commissar wants this incident to become a matter for official inquiry."
Corbeck looked at the boy curiously, but Gaunt nodded. In his experience, there was no point fighting the boy's gift for judgment. Milo never intruded into the Commissar's privacy, but he seemed to understand instinctively Gaunt's intentions and wishes. Gaunt could not keep secrets from the boy, but he trusted him and valued his insight beyond measure. Gaunt looked at Corbeck.
"Bryn's right. There's more to this. I'll explain later, but I want the ship hierarchy kept out of it until we know who to trust."
The weapons alarm continued to sound.
"In that case, we better get out of here," Corbeck began.
He was cut off by the elevator shutters gliding open with a breathy hiss and a choral exhalation. Six Imperial Navy troopers in fiber-weave shipboard armor and low-brimmed helmets exited in a pack and dropped to their knees, covering the trio with compact stub guns. One barked curt orders into his helmet voxlink. An officer emerged from the elevator in their wake. Like them, his uniform was emerald with silver piping, the colors of the Segmentum Pacificus fleet, but he was not armored like his detail. He was tall, a little overweight, and his puffy flesh was unhealthily pale. A career spacer, thought Corbeck. Probably hasn't stood on real soil in decades. The officer stared at them. The shaggy guard miscreant with his unauthorized las pistol, the injured, bloody man leaning against him and bleeding on the deck, the rangy, strange-eyed boy. He pursed his lips, spoke quietly into his own voxlink, and then touched a stud on the facilitator wand he carried, waving it absently into the air around him. The alarm shut off mid-whine.
I am Warrant Officer Lekulansi. It is my responsibility to oversee the security of this vessel on behalf of Lord Captain Grasticus. I take a dim view of illicit weapons on this holy craft, though I always expect Imperial Guard scum to try something. I look with even greater displeasure on the use of said weapons.
Now, this is not how it look, Korbeck began, moving forward with a reassuring smile. Six stub-gun muzzles swung their attention directly at him. The details weapons were short-line, pump-action models designed for shipboard use. The glass shards and wire twists wadded into each shell would roar out in a tightly packed cone of micro-shrapnel, entirely capable of shredding a man at close range. But unlike a lasgun or a bolter, there was no danger of them puncturing the outer hull.
No hasty movements, no eager explanations.
Lekulansi stared at them.
Questions will be answered in due time, under the formal process of your interrogation. You are aware that the firing of a prohibited weapon on a transport vessel of the Adeptus Mechanicus is an offense punishable by court-martial. Surrender your weapon.
Korbeck handed his las pistol to the trooper, who rose smartly to take it from him.
This is stupid, Gaunt said abruptly.
The guns turned their attention to him.
Do you know who I am, Lekulansi?
The warrant officer tensed as his name was used without formal title. He narrowed his flesh-hooded eyes. Gaunt hauled himself forward and stood free of Korbeck's support.
I am Commissar Colonel Ibram Gaunt.
Warrant Officer Lekulansi froze. Without the coat, the cap, the badges of authority, Gaunt looked like any low-born guard officer.
Come here,
Gaunt told him. The man hesitated, then crossed to Gaunt, whispering a low order into his voxlink. The guard detail immediately rose from their knees, snapped to attention, and slung their weapons.
That's better, Korbeck smiled.
Gaunt placed a hand on Lekulansi's shoulder, and the officer stiffened with outrage. Gaunt was pointing to something on the deck, a charred greenish slick or stain, oily and lumpy.
Do you know what that is?
Lekulansi shook his head.
It's the remains of an assassin who set upon me here. The weapon's discharge was my first officer saving my life. I will formally caution him for concealing a firearm aboard, strictly against standing orders.
Gaunt smiled to see a tiny bead of nervous perspiration begin to streak Lekulansi's pallid brow.
He was one of yours, Lekulansi. A rating. But he was in the sway of others. Dark forces that beguiled and drove him like a toy. You don't like illicit weapons on your ship, eh? How about illicit psychers?
Some of the security troopers muttered and made warding gestures.
Lekulansi stammered, But who? Who would want to kill you, sir? I am a soldier. A successful soldier,
Gaunt smiled coldly.
I make enemies all the time.
He gestured down at the remains.
Have this analyzed, then have it purged. Make sure no foul, unholy taint has touched this precious ship. Report any findings directly to me, no matter how insignificant. Once my wounds have been treated, I will report to Lord Captain Grasticus personally and submit a full account.
Lekulansi was lost for words. With Korbeck supporting him, Gaunt left the glass bay. At the elevator doors, Lekulansi caught the hard look in the boy's eyes. He shuddered. In the elevator, Milo turned to Gaunt.
His eyes were like a snake's. He is not trustworthy.
Gaunt nodded. He had changed his mind. Just minutes before, he had reconciled himself to acting as Ferid's courier, guardian to the crystal. But now things had changed. He wouldn't sit by, idly waiting. He would act with purpose. He would enter the game and find out the rules and learn how to win. That would mean learning the contents of the crystal. 4.
Best I can do,
murmured Dorden, the ghost's chief medic, making a half-hearted gesture around him that implicated the whole of the regimental infirmary. The ghost's infirmary was a suite of three low, corbel-vaulted rooms set as an annex to the barrack deck where the Tanith First were berthed. Its walls and roof were washed with a greenish off-white paint, and the hard floors had been lined with scrubbed redstone tiles. On dull steel shelves in bays around the rooms were ranked fat, glass-stoppered bottles with yellowing paper labels, mostly full of treacly fluids, surgical pastes, dried powders and preparations, or organic field swabs in clear, gluey suspensions. Racks of polished instruments sat in pull-out drawers and plastic waste bags. Stale bedding and bandage rolls were packed into low, lidded boxes around the walls that doubled as seats. There was a murky autoclave on a brass trolley, two Resuscitrex units with shiny iron paddles, and a side table with an apothecary's scales, a diagnostic probe and a blood cleanser set on it. The air was musty and rank, and there were dark stains on the flooring.
"We're not over-equipped, as you can see,"
Dawden added breezily. He'd patched the commissar's wounds with supplies from his own field kit, which sat open on one of the bench lockers. He hadn't trusted the freshness or sterility of any of the materials provided by the infirmary. Gaunt sat, stripped to the waist, on one of the low brass gurneys which lined the center of the main chamber, its wheels locked into restraining lugs in the tiled floor. The gurney's springs squeaked and moaned as Gaunt shifted his weight on the stained, stinking mattress. Dawden had patched the wound in the commissar's shoulder with sterile dressings, washed the whole limb in pungent blue sterilizing gel, and then pinched the mouth of the wound shut with Bakelite suture clamps that looked like the heads of biting insects. Gaunt tried to flex his arm.
"Don't do that," Dawden said quickly. "I'd wrap it in false flesh if I could find any, but besides, the wound should breathe. Honestly, you'd be better off in the main hospital ward."
Gaunt shook his head. "You've done a fine job," he said. Dawden smiled. He didn't want to press the commissar on the issue. Corbeck had muttered something about keeping this private. Dawden was a small man, older than most of the ghosts, with a grey beard and warm eyes. He'd been a doctor on Tanith, running an extended practice through the farms and settlements of Beldane and the forest wilds of County Prize. He'd been drafted at the founding to fulfill the administratum's requirements for regimental medical personnel. His wife had died a year before the founding, and his only son was a trooper in the 9th platoon. His one daughter, her husband, and their firstborn had perished in the flames of Tanith. He had left nothing behind in the embers of his homeworld, except the memory of years of community service, a duty he now carried on for the good of the last men of Tanith. He refused to carry a weapon, and thus was the only ghost that Gaunt couldn't rely on to fight. But Gaunt hardly cared. He had 60 or 70 men in his command who wouldn't still be there but for Dawden.
"I've checked for venom taint or fiber toxin. You're lucky. The blade was clean. Cleaner than mine,"
Dawden chuckled, and it made Gaunt smile.
"Unusual,"
Dawden added, and fell silent. Gaunt raised an eyebrow. "How so?"
"I understood assassins like to toxify their blades as insurance,"
Dawden said simply. "I never said it was an assassin."
"You didn't have to. I may be a non-combatant. Faith, I may be an old fool, but I didn't come down in the last barrage."
"Don't trouble yourself with it, Dawden," Gaunt said, flexing his arm again against the medic's advice. It stung, ached, throbbed. "You've worked your usual magic. Stay impartial. Don't get drawn in." Dawden was scrubbing his suture clamp and wound probes in a bowl of filmy antiseptic oil.
"Impartial? Do you know something, Ibram Gaunt?"
Gaunt blinked as if slapped. No one had spoken to him with such paternal authority since the last time he had been in the company of his uncle Dercius. No, not the last time. Dawden turned back, wiping the tools on the sheets of white lint.
"Forgive me, Commissar, I am speaking out of turn."
"Speak anyway, friend." Dawden jerked a lean thumb to indicate out beyond the archway into the barrack deck.
"These are all I've got. The last pitiful scraps of Tanith gene stock. My only link to the past, and to the green, green world I loved. I'll keep patching and mending and binding and sewing them back together until they're all gone, or I'm gone, or the horizons of all known space have withered and died. And while you may not be Tanith, I know many of the men now treat you as such. Me?
I'm not sure.
too much of the Chulainn about you, I'd say.
Chulainn?
Chulainn. Forgive me, slipping into the old tongue. Outsider. Unknown. It doesn't translate directly.
I'm sure it doesn't.
It wasn't an insult. You may not be Tanith breed, but you're for us every way. I think you care, Gaunt. Care about your ghosts. I think you'll do all in your power to see us right, to take us to glory, to take us to peace. That's what I believe every night when I lay down to rest, and every time a bombardment starts, or the dropships fall, or the boys go over the wire. That matters.
Gaunt shrugged, and wished he hadn't. Does it?
I've spoken to medics and with other regiments. At the field hospital on Fortis, for instance. So many of them say their commissars don't care a jot about their men. They see them as fodder for the guns. Is that how you see us?
No.
No, I thought not. So that makes you rare indeed. Something worth hanging on to, for the good of these poor ghosts. Feth, you may not be Tanith, but if assassins are starting to hunger for your blood, I start to care. For the ghosts, I care.
He fell silent.
Then I'll remember not to leave you uninformed,
Gaunt said, reaching for his undershirt.
I thank you for that. For a Chulainn, you're a good man, Ibram Gaunt. Like the Anroch back home.
Gaunt froze.
What did you say?
Dordan looked round at him sharply.
Anroch. I said Anroth. It wasn't an insult either.
What does it mean? Dordan hesitated uneasily, unsettled by Gaunt's hard gaze.
The Anroth, well, household spirits. It's a cradle tale from Tanith. They used to say that the Anroth were spirits from other worlds, beautiful worlds of order, who came to Tanith to watch over our families. It's nothing. Just an old memory. A forest saying.
Why does it matter, Commissar?
Said a new voice. Gaunt and Dordan looked around to see Milo sat on a bench seat near the door, watching them intently.
How long have you been there?
Gaunt asked sharply, surprising himself with his anger.
A few minutes only. The Anroth are part of Tanith lore, like the Drudfelad, who ward the trees, and the Niasis, who watch over the streams and waters.
Why would it alarm you so?
I've heard the word before. Somewhere, Gaunt said, getting to his feet. Who knows? A word like it? It doesn't matter.
He went to pull on his undershirt, but realized it was ripped and bloody, and cast it aside. Milo, get me another from my quarters, he snapped. Milo rose and handed Gaunt a fresh undershirt from his canvas pack. Dordan covered a grin. Gaunt faltered, nodded his thanks, and took the shirt. Both Milo and the medical officer had noticed the multitude of scars which laced Gaunt's broad, muscled torso, and had made no comment. How many theatres, how many fronts, how many life-or-death combats had it taken to accumulate so many marks of pain? But, as Gaunt stood, Dordan noticed the scar across Gaunt's belly for the first time, and gasped. The wound line was long and ancient, a grotesque braid of buckled scar tissue.
Sacred Feth, Dordan said too loudly. Where?
Gaunt shook him off.
It's old. Very old.
Gaunt slipped on his undershirt, and the wound was hidden. He pulled up his braces and reached for his tunic.
But how did you get such a...
Gaunt looked at him sharply.
Enough.
Gaunt buttoned his tunic, and then put on the long leather coat which Milo was already holding for him. He set his cap on his head.
Are the officers ready?
He asked.
Milo nodded. As you ordered.
With a nod to Dordan, Gaunt marched out of the infirmary. 5. It had crossed his mind to wonder who to trust. That he could trust all of them. A few minutes' thought had brought him to the realization that he could trust them all. Every one of the ghosts, from Colonel Corbeck down to the lowliest of the troopers. His only qualm lay with the malcontent Rorn and his immediate group of cronies in the 3rd platoon, men like Fagor. Gaunt left the infirmary and walked down the short companionway into the barrack deck proper. Corbeck was waiting.
Colm Corbeck had been waiting for almost an hour. Alone in the antechamber of the infirmary, he had enjoyed plenty of time to fret about the things he hated most in the universe. First and last of them was space travel. Corbeck was the son of a machine smith who had worked his living at a forge beneath the gable barn on the first wide bend of the River Prize. Most of his father's work had come from log-handling machines, rasp saws, timber derricks, track sleds. Many times, as a boy, he'd shimmied down into the oily service trenches to hold the inspection lamp so his father could examine the knotted dripping axles and stricken synchro mesh of a 20-wheeled flatbed, ailing under its cargo of young, wet wood from the mills up at Beldane or Sotrus. Growing up, he'd worked the reaper mills in Sotrus and seen men lose fingers, hands, and knees to the screaming bandsaws and circular razors. His lungs had clogged with saw mist, and he had developed a hacking cough that lingered even now. Then he'd joined the militia of Tanith Magna on a dare, and on top of a broken heart, and patrolled the sacred stretches of the prize county Nalwood groves for poachers and smugglers. It had been a right enough life, the loamy earth below, the trees above, and the far starlight beyond the leaves. He'd come to understand the ways of the twisting forests, and the shifting Nal groves and clearings. He'd learned the knife, the stealth patterns, and the joy of the hunt. He'd been happy, so long as the stars had been up there and the ground underfoot. Now, the ground was gone. Gone forever. The damp, piney scents of the forest soil, the rich sweetness of the leaf mould, the soft depths of the Nal spores as they drifted and accumulated. He'd sung songs up to the stars, taken their silent blessing, even cursed them. All so long as they were far away, he never thought he would travel in their midst. Corbeck was afraid of the crossings, as he knew many of his company were afraid, even now after so many of them. To leave soil, to leave land, sea, and sky behind, to part the stars and crusade through the Immaterium, that was truly terrifying. He knew the Absalom was a sturdy ship. He'd seen its vast bulk from the view spaces of the dock ship that had brought him aboard. But he had also seen the great timber barges of the mills founder, shudder, and splinter in the hard watercourses of the Beldane Rapids. Ships sailed their ways, he knew, until the ways got too strong for them and gave them up. He hated it all. The smell of the air, the coldness of the walls, the inconstancy of the artificial gravity, the perpetual constancy of the vibrating Imperium drives. All of it. Only his concern for the Commissar's welfare had got him past his phobias onto the nightmare of the Glass Bay Observatory. Even then, he'd focused his attention on Gaunt, the troopers, that idiot warrant officer, anything at all but the cavorting insanity beyond the glass. He longed for soil underfoot, for real air, for breeze and rain and the hush of nodding branches. Corbeck, he snapped to attention as Gaunt approached. Milo was a little way behind the Commissar.
Sir.
Remember what I was telling you in the bar on Pyrites?
Not precisely, sir. I was pretty far gone.
Gaunt grinned. Good. Then it will all come as a surprise to you, too. Are the officers ready? Corbeck nodded perfunctorily.
Except Major Ron, as you ordered.
Gaunt lifted his cap, smoothed his cropped hair back with his hands, and replaced it squarely again.
A moment, and I'll join you in the staff room.
Gaunt marched away down the deck and entered the main billet of the barracks. The ghosts had been given Barrack Deck 3, a vast honeycomb of long dark vaults in which bunks were strung from chains in a herringbone pattern. Adjoining these sleeping vaults was a desolate recreation hall and a trio of padded exercise chambers. All 40 surviving platoons, a little over 2,000 ghosts, were billeted here. The smell of sweat, smoke, and body heat rose from the bunk vaults. Rorn, Fagor, and the rest of the 3rd platoon were waiting for him on the slip ramp. They had been training in the exercise chambers, and each one carried one of the shock poles provided for combat practice. These neural stunners were the only weapons allowed to them during a crossing. They could fence with them, spar with them, and even set them to long-range discharge and target shoot against the squeaking, moving metal decoys in the badly oiled automatic range. Gaunt saluted Rorn. The men snapped to attention.
How do you read the barrack deck, Major?
Rorn faltered.
Commissar? Is it secure?
There are 8 deployment shafts and 2 to the dropship hangar, plus a number of service ways. Take your men, spread out and guard them all. No one must get in or out of this barrack deck without my knowledge. Rawn looked faintly perplexed. How do we hold any intruders off, Commissar, given our lack of weapons? Gaunt took a shock pole from Trooper Neff and then laid him out on the deck with a jolt to the belly. Use these, Gaunt suggested. Report to me every half hour. Report to me directly with the name of anyone who attempts access. Pausing for a moment to study Rawn's face and make sure his instructions were clearly understood, Gaunt turned and walked back up the ramp.
What's he up to?
Fagor asked the Major when Gaunt was out of earshot. Rawn shook his head. He would find out. Until he did, he had a sentry duty to organize. 6. The staff room was an old briefing theatre next to the infirmary annex. Steps led down into a circular room with 3 tiers of varnished wooden seats around the circumference and a lacquered black console in the centre on a dais. The console, squat and rounded like a polished mushroom, was an old tactical display unit with a mirrored screen in its top, which had once broadcast luminous 3-dimensional hololithic forms into the air above it during strategy councils. But it was old and broken. Gaunt used it as a seat. The officers filed in. Corbeck, Dorden, and then the platoon leaders. Merrin, McCall, Corral, Lerod, Hasker, Blaine, Forlaw. 39 men, all told. Last in was Val, recently promoted. Milo closed the shutter hatch and perched at the back. The men sat in a semicircle, facing their commander.
What's going on, sir?
Val asked. Gaunt smiled slightly. As a newcomer to officer-level briefings, Val was eager and forthright, and oblivious to the usually reserved protocols of staff discussions. I should have promoted him earlier, Gaunt thought wryly.
This is totally unofficial. Ghost business, but unofficial. I want to advise you of a situation so that you can be aware of it and act accordingly if the need arises. But it does not go beyond this chamber. Tell your men as much as they need to know to facilitate matters, but spare them the details.
He had their attention now.
I won't dress this up. As far as I know, and believe me, that's no further than I could throw brag, there's a power struggle going on. One that threatens to tear this whole crusade to tatters. You've all heard how much infighting went on after War Master Slado's death, how many of the Lord High Militants wanted to take his place.
And that Weasel Makaroth got it, Corbeck said with a rueful grin. That's War Master Weasel Makaroth, Colonel, Gaunt corrected. He let the men chuckle. Good humor would make this easier.
Like him or not, he's in charge now, and that makes it simple for us. Like me, you are all loyal to the Emperor, and therefore to War Master Makaroth. Slado chose him to be successor. Makaroth's word is the word of the Golden Throne itself. He speaks with Imperium authority.
Gaunt paused. The men watched him quizzically, as if they had missed the point of some joke.
But someone's not happy about that, are they?
Milo said dourly from the back. The officers snapped around to stare at him, and then turned back equally sharply as they heard the Commissar laugh.
Indeed, there are probably many who resent his promotion over them, and one in particular we all know, if only by name. Lord Militant General Drevere, the very man who commands our section of the Crusade Force.
What are you saying, sir?
Lerod asked with aghast disbelief. Lerod was a large, shaven-headed sergeant with an Imperial Eagle tattoo on his temple. He had commanded the militia unit in Tenneth Ultima, the Imperial Shrine City on the Ghost's lost home world, and as a result, he, along with the other troopers from Ultima, were the most devoted and resolute Imperial servants in the Tenneth First. Gaunt knew that Lerod would be perhaps the most difficult to convince.
Are you suggesting the Lord General Drevere has renegade tendencies? That he is disloyal? But he's your direct superior, sir.
Which is why this discussion is being held in private. If I'm right, who can we turn to? The men greeted this with uncomfortable silence. Gaunt went on.
Drevere has never hidden the fact that he felt Slado snubbed him by appointing the younger Makaroth. It must rankle deeply to serve under an upstart who has been promoted past you. I am pretty certain that Drevere plans to usurp the War Master.
Let them fight for it,
Val spat, and others concurred.
What's another dead officer? Begging your pardon, sir.
Gaunt smiled. You echo my initial thoughts on the matter, Sergeant. But think it through. If Drevere moves his own forces against Makarov, it will weaken this entire endeavor. Weaken it at the very moment we should be consolidating for the push into new, more hostile territories. What good are we against the forces of the enemy if we're battling with ourselves? If it came to it, we'd be wide open, weak, and ripe for slaughter. Drevere's plans threaten the entire future of us all. Another heavy silence. Gaunt rubbed his lean chin. If Drevere goes through with this, we could throw everything away. Everything we've won in the Sabbat worlds these last 10 years. Gaunt leaned forward. There's more. If I was going to usurp the Warmaster, I'd want a whole lot more than a few loyal regiments with me. I'd want an edge.
Is that what this is about?
The Rod asked, now hanging on Gaunt's words. Of course it is. Drevere is after something. Something big. Something so big it will actually place him on an equal footing with the Warmaster. Or even make him stronger. And that is where we pitiful few come into the picture. He paused for a moment. When I was on Pyrites, I came into possession of this. Gaunt held up the crystal. The information encrypted onto this crystal holds the key to it all. Drevere's spy network was transmitting it back to him, and it was intercepted.
By who? Larod asked.
By Makaroth's loyal spy network, Imperial Intelligence, working to undermine Drevere's conspiracy. They are covert, vulnerable, few, but they are the only things working against the mechanisms of Drevere's ascendancy.
Where are you?
Dorden asked quietly. Gaunt paused. Even now he could not tell them the real reason, that it was foretold.
I was there, and I was trusted. I don't understand it all. An old friend of mine is part of the intelligence hub, and he contacted me to caretake this precious cargo. It seemed there was no one else on Pyrites close enough or trusted enough to do it.
Val shifted in his seat, scratching his shoulder implant.
So? What's on it?
I have no idea, Gaunt said. It's encoded. Larod started to say something else, but Gaunt added, It's Vermilion level. There was a long pause, accompanied only by Blaine's long, impressed whistle.
Now do you see? Gaunt asked. What do we do?
Val said dully.
We find out what's on it. Then we decide.
But how?
Merrin began, but Gaunt held up a calming hand.
That's my job, and I think I can do it. Easily, in fact. After that, well, that's why I wanted you all in on this. Already Drevere's covert network has attempted to kill me and retrieve the crystal. Twice. Once on Pyrites, and now here again on the ship. I need you with me to guard this priceless thing, to keep the Lord Militant General's spies from it, to cover me until I can see the way clear to the action we should take.
Silence reigned in the staff room.
Are you with me?
Gaunt asked. The silence beat on, almost stifling. The officers exchanged furtive glances. In the end, it was Larod who spoke for them. Gaunt was particularly glad it was Larod.
Do you have to ask, Commissar?
He said simply. Gaunt smiled his thanks. He got up from the display unit and stepped off the dais as the men rose.
Let's get to it. Rawn's already setting patrols to keep this barrack deck secure. Support and bolster that effort. I want to feel confident that the area of this ship given over to us is safe ground. Keep intruders out, or escort them directly to me. If the men question the precautions, tell them we think that those damn patricians might try something to ease their grudge against us. Terra knows that's true enough, and there are over 4 times our number of patricians aboard this vessel on the other barrack decks. And the patricians are undoubtedly in Drevere's pocket. I also want the entire deck searched for hidden vox relays and vista lines. Haska, Val, use any men you know with technical aptitude to perform the sweep. They may be trying all manner of ways of spying on us. From this moment on, trust no one outside our regiment. No one. There is no way of telling who might be part of the conspiracy around us. The officers seemed eager but unsettled.
Gaunt knew that this was strange work for regular soldiers. They filed out, faces grave. Gaunt looked at the crystal in his hand. "What are you hiding?" he wondered. 7. Gaunt returned to his quarters with the silent Milo in tow. Korbeck had set two ghosts to guard the commissar's private room.